Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
And welcome to Off Script. There are many in musical theater who've made a career in a specific discipline, like directing or playwriting, that has spanned decades. But there are a few who've been lyricist and book writer and director and producer. Oh, yeah, and when it comes to movies, screenwriter too. Off Script's guest today is one of those great multi-talented few, he being Richard Maltby Jr., starting with his composer collaborator David Shire back at Yale. Richard has written the lyrics for Starting Here, Starting Now, Baby, Big, based on the movie starring Tom Hanks, Nick and Nora, and a bunch of others. For his directing, Richard won a Tony Award for Ain't Misbehavin' and an Olivier Award in London for Fosse. He also wrote the lyrics for Miss Saigon, which is seeing a Broadway revival this season, and he's currently at work on a new Broadway-bound musical called Suzatska, based on the novel Madame Suzatska by Bernice Rubens. And he joins us today from the rehearsal hall for that new musical in Toronto, where it will have its world premiere in February. Welcome, Richard.
Well, hello, Dan.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm thrilled that you're here, but there's so much to talk about because you've done it all and seen it all, but let's just start with now. So how did you get involved with this musical version of Suzatska?
Fosse. I directed Fosse for Garth Drabinski, and it's been a pet project of his, and he and I wanted to work together again, and he asked me to come in and do the David Shire and I to do the score, and Craig Lucas is doing the book. Craig wrote Light in the Piazza, among other things, and Prelude to a Kiss, a wonderful playwright. It's directed by Adrian Noble, formerly the head of the Royal Shakespeare Company. It's designed by the great Anthony Ward, one of England's best set designers. The lighting designer and costume designer are the same ones for Hamilton. It's just about the top of the line production in every way, and it's really thrilling to work with. It's a kind of a privilege to work with the best people in the business. So the rehearsals are going extremely well, and I must say I'm very excited about how the show is going.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a real powerhouse of talent and an incredible portfolio that each of the creative principals bring. And are you all there during rehearsals? I guess because I'm curious, maybe we can let some of the listeners know how much really gets changed in rehearsals. I mean, if Craig Lucas is there and he changes the book, does that mean you've got to change some of the lyrics that lead from the change that he made in the books? How does that dynamic work?
Well, we actually took a much longer process. We did a 2-week reading of the show in January, after which we did a good deal of rewriting. We did a 6-week workshop in June in Toronto, and did a good deal of rewriting during that process, and put into it all the rewriting we'd done before that. And since June, we've done a great deal of work, but surprisingly, not as much as often happens. The workshop went really, really well, and everyone was very pleased with it. So we've done what's basically fine-tuning of it. So a lot of the work that would normally be done in rehearsal, in sort of testing things and trying things and changing a scene, we've changed the scene already. We've tried 3 different ways, and we have pretty much the version that we're going to use. So I would say this is the least amount of rewriting I've ever done during a rehearsal period.
Fascinating. If you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, and my guest today is Richard Maltby Jr., the lyricist, book writer, director, and producer of so many Broadway musicals, talking to us from the rehearsal hall for Suzatska, a Broadway-bound new musical having its world premiere in Toronto. You said that you worked really, really well in workshop, and I made a distinction in my introduction of the play to say that it's based on the book. Now, some people may know this story from the movie. Could you tell us why it's based on the book and not the screenplay?
I can't really tell you that because there's a little bit of stuff that we use from the screenplay. The screenplay adapted stuff from the book, and we just went back to the original source. And there were not too many things that were altered in the movie, and so the movie is, in a sense, you could say we're based on the movie as well. But we've basically done exactly what the book did. But we have changed. We've made some substantial changes. It's about a Polish music teacher escaped from during the war, who comes to London. She is a great, and idiosyncratic teacher of classical music, and she is brought a 16-year-old prodigy who, in our version, is from South Africa, a sort of refugee from the apartheid battles of the early 80s, and she sets out to change his life, but in fact he changes hers, and so it has echoes. It has great echoes of that are extraordinarily timely these days. I mean, it's about what it means to be an exile, or, you know, if you're an exile, who are you? It's about personal and national identity and.
Is it also about racial identity? Because the original story was about an Indian immigrant, I think, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. And so to that extent, it is still, yes, there are huge racial aspects to it, because this boy, in the 1980s, South Africa, which has a rich musical tradition, it's mostly jazz, and they had never produced a classical artist of world stature. That's not true now, but it was true then. So this boy, who is a fictional character, would have been an anomaly even in his own country. And it is also about art's ability to heal and to reach over boundaries. And it has echoes of Nelson Mandela's concept, the Rainbow Nation, that was sort of unique in the history of mankind. He could have, when he came to power, just been vindictive about all of the oppression that had happened from the whites to the blacks, but instead created a nation in which all colors, all tribes, all of the various forces would live together, be proud of their natural heritage, and live together.
Right. The anecdotes come up recently about how instead of eschewing the popular all-white, was it rugby, a soccer team of the country, he actually embraced it and encouraged African people to listen.
He knew. Yeah. There's a wonderful, wonderful movie with Matt Damon. One of the things he knew in order to create this new identity, he made this guy have a mixed race soccer team.
Yep.
That would be a symbol for the country.
Yep.
And it actually did exactly that. Rainbow Nation is one of the big songs of the show, actually.
Getting back to the songs of the show, and given the nature of the story, it seems that David Shire's compositions might range from the classical to the jazz, with a lot of African kind of influences in between.
It's the widest ranging score we have ever done.
So how does that inform the kind of lyrics you put into those songs?
Well, you know, lyrics come from the characters who are singing them. So different songs have different voices. I mean, not just different words, but they actually have the characteristics of different characters. So we have all of Western classical music, because she's a classical music teacher. We have South African jazz. We have amalgams of all of those. We have London in the 1980s, which was sort of either it was punk and goth, or it was George Michael's. that's coexisting, and it's a great mixture of cultures and a great mixture of energies, which I think has produced it's certainly the most varied score we've ever written, and we're really proud of it. We also have been working with a man named Lebo M, who was one of the major contributors to The Lion King, we asked if he would be interested in helping us bring authenticity to the South African music, and he was thrilled to do it because he said that's my story.
Right.
He was himself a musical prodigy, and he left South Africa at 16 in order to pursue a career outside of in America, and so. Every piece of this story resonates to him. He said, I'm happy that you're paying me, but I'd do it for nothing.
So you're opening in Toronto in February, running for, I think, about almost 2 months. Do you have a date yet when it might come to New York?
No, we open here, and then we will just see. But I'll tell you what I just learned yesterday.
Yeah.
We open here on March 28th. And guess what else opens on March 28th?
I think that was the lead into my next question. You tell me.
Miss Saigon in New York, the revival
nice
of Miss Saigon.
Segue.
I mean, how many times do I have, big opening nights? Do they have to happen on the same day?
The opening is the same day.
The opening is the same day.
Oh, my gosh. So we know where you're going to be in Toronto, right?
Well, I actually don't know. Completely torn. I want to be in both places at the same time.
So
the Miss Saigon opening is a really big deal, and I don't know.
That is weird. So how did the revival that's opening on March 28th on Broadway of Miss Saigon, am I mistaken? Is this the production that was in London a couple of years ago?
It's exactly that okay. production.
Right.
Yes.
So what is different about it this time? We heard a little bit about, I think, it being more, a little bit not reconceived, but maybe refocused a little bit. And if it is, then why is it time ripe now, besides maybe just the commercial imperative? I don't know.
It's a little bit more realistic. I mean, a little darker. It's not really altered that much. I think it's dramatically a little more intense than it was the first time around. The first time, when we opened in London, it was 1989, which was only 15 years after after the end of the Vietnamese War, and the war had ended so disastrously for the United States. And it was such a blow to our national mythology. I mean, we, America, first of all, John Wayne comes over the hill and saves the day. We always win, and we're always the good guy. And John Wayne didn't come over the hill and save the day, and we were the bad guys. And we didn't win. A tremendous blow to everything we believed about ourselves. And basically, America didn't really want to look at it for about 10 years. 10 years after, during the 10 years after the war, just about every movie or play or book that came out about the Vietnamese War was not a success. 10 years later, Platoon opened, and it was a huge hit and won the Academy Award. And then it seemed like enough time had gone by so that people could look at the subject again.
Yeah. In case you've just joined us, my guest is Richard Maltby, Jr., the program off script. Richard is talking to us from a rehearsal hall in Toronto where they're rehearsing Suzatska, a new musical that's eventually Broadway bound. Richard is, of course, the lyricist for Starting Here, Starting Now, Baby, Big, Nick and Nora, and Miss Saigon, which opens on Broadway in a revival on March 28th. Richard, let's go way back. You grew up...
Just to correct you, it's the 23rd.
The opening in Toronto is March 23rd, and Miss Saigon on Broadway, March 23rd. Thank you.
The same day.
The same day. Let's go way back. You grew up in a showbiz musical family. Your father was a band leader, right?
Yeah, I mean, and before he was a band leader, he was a major league arranger. He did symphonic arrangements. He did arrangements for pop people like Sarah Vaughan and that sort of thing for recordings. He was Ethel Merman's musical director for the only radio show she ever did. He did things like that. So I grew up with music in the house all the time, and I would go to his recording sessions and just sit in the orchestra and just listen to them.
So was this career of yours, was it inevitable, or was it maybe even genetic?
My mother was trained as a ballerina and then gave it up when she got married. So I'm sure it's somewhere in the genes. And if it wasn't in the genes, it was in the drinking water. We loved the theater. My father was the sweetest man. His idea of a really good time was to go and stand in the middle of Times Square and look at the lights. So that's where I come from.
I get off on it. I mean, every time I walk across Times Square to go to a theater, I get a thrill.
And at 7:45, when from all over the city, the streets are just and the sidewalk are just filled with crowds going in to fill up the theaters. It's so moving.
It really is.
It's just kind of thrilling.
It is.
Who knows what they're going to see? They're going to see whatever they see. But they're all going, and that's just wonderful.
So showbiz was definitely in the blood. So let me ask an obvious question and a really corny question. The obvious question is, who did you listen to? What kind of songs did you listen to, and how did that influence what you ended up writing the words for? And the other question that's really corny is, what was the first musical you ever saw?
First musical I ever saw was Carousel. I was really young, and all I remember is that it had a carousel in the first scene, and I kept saying to my mother, "When's the carousel coming back?" And she kept saying, shut up, next scene. Of course, you know, the scene after the carousel scene is about 25 minutes long during the If I Loved You, and the set never changes, and I was just getting tremendously antsy, and finally the scene ended, and the curtain went up on the next scene, and there is no carousel, because, of course, the carousel never comes back in the show. I remember that. I saw Where's Charlie? I saw Guys and Dolls. Those were the earliest shows that I saw, and they were from everyone. I took some kind of iconic memory. I was doomed.
Yeah. But, I mean, was it Harold Arlen? Was it Cole Porter? Was it Gershwin? Was it all of the above?
It was not Cole Porter or Gershwin particularly. It was Rodgers and Hammerstein and Frank Lesser. Funnily enough, though, you know, I saw Where's Charlie and Guys and Dolls, and those are both Frank Lesser shows.
Right.
And then Carousel, I don't think I saw Oklahoma. I did see South Pacific and The King and I.
Did you see the recent revival downtown that they had up in the Berkshires last summer on Fiorello?
No, I didn't.
No, but, okay. Well, I guess the question is, what is there about Lesser's lyrics or his sensitivity that sort of impressed you?
Well, the lyrics, the language in Guys and Dolls is just about perfect. I mean, really, Adelaide's Lament, unbelievably perfect. The oldest established permanent floating crap game. The jokes in that song and in the whole show are just wonderful and a kind of a model of efficiency and absolute tight focus in terms of writing. I don't think I knew that about them. I just thought they were funny or delightful, and they I guess I was learning something because it went through into my skin somehow. I had a marionette theater. I used to put on shows in my basement, that sort of thing. So somewhere along the line, I decided I was going to write one of them. I really wanted to be a set designer.
Really?
And musicals have more scenery in it, so that's why I thought I wanted to do musicals, because they had more scenery. Then I discovered I couldn't draw, which was a real impediment to my career. And by then I was always the person who was making people do a musical, and I could find a composer and I could find someone to write the script, but nobody ever wanted to write the lyrics, so I ended up writing the lyrics, and suddenly I found myself a lyricist. But really, I don't think of myself as a lyricist. I think of myself as a show creator.
Mm-hmm. And of the shows that you've created, which is the one, you know, that's going to get – that you would put in the list at the top of the list?
Well, the most satisfying artistic experience, all told, was putting Miss Saigon together, which I think is really an achievement. It's of all of the British import shows, it's the best play, I think, the best written musical play, and I'm very proud of that. And even though every word of it is sung, it plays like scenes. Personally, the score to Baby has my heart. I mean, it's the most sort of varied and personal and emotional songs that I think David and I have ever written.
Mm-hmm. When you write with David, you lay down the lyric, and then he comes up with a melody or motif, or do you follow?
We usually do it the other way around. Uh-huh. We talk about it a lot. We get a sort of a structure for the song. It's going to start here, you know, as a scene. How's the song? It's going to start here. It's going to go there. And sometimes there's a title. And if we have the character in that structure, David very often says, well, what if it goes something like this? And he will play something. And if he's got the character right in his heart, the melody is a really strong expression of that. We then work over the melody until the melody seems to be actually having the words in it. And then I go and write the lyrics, which are then to the very, very strict rhythms and odd rhythms that the melody might have. I think probably part of the reason why our songs play very well on the stage is because the music is written, at least the words are written exactly to the rhythms of the music.
Right. So we've talked about you being a lyricist, about being a conceptualizer, a conceiver of productions, of being a producer. Before we end, I need some comments about you being a director. Does that give you the most creative control over what finally an audience sees on the stage?
Yeah, when I started out, I don't think of myself as a lyricist. I think of myself as a show creator, which is and directing a musical is not really directing. Directing a musical is really the creating of the show, pulling it together from all of the elements. And when I think about a show, I think about the whole thing. So it was not terribly far away to move into directing a musical. And I also found that I have sort of idiosyncratic quirks as a writer that directors often didn't understand. But you know what? I understand it. So if I'm directing my own material, at least the way I see it is what happens on the stage. So I set out to train myself as a director, and after about, you know, 7 or 8 years of doing nightclub acts and any kind of benefits and anything that came along, I was asked to do an evening of a cabaret evening based on the music of Fats Waller, who I'd been working on as a sort of a book musical. He didn't go anywhere as a book musical, but I thought that he was a wonderful character. And so we went into rehearsal with that, and 4 weeks later we had Ain't Misbehavin', and 4 weeks after that, 8 weeks after that, we were in rehearsal for Broadway, and 4 weeks after that, we opened on Broadway and won the Tony Award and everything you can win in New York. So
In about 7 weeks from now, you will have two openings, March 23rd.
On the same day.
Isn't Saigon on Broadway, yeah. And in Toronto, the new Broadway-bound musical, Suzatska.
Richard, on the other hand, it's exciting, you know. It means you're still doing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, keep on doing. And I want to thank you so much for being here. It's been great
really
having
happy,
you a guest.
Dan.
And we'll see Saigon, and we hope to see Suzatska in New York sometime as well.
Great.
Thank you, Richard.
My wish too. Good. Bye bye.
If you've been listening to us and enjoying the program, please go to robinhoodradio.com. There is a donate tab. Go to it and express your support, because we are supported from listeners like you. The program has been Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. Program underwritten by Johnny Cake Books. Thanks again to Richard Maltby Jr., the creator of so many great Broadway shows, including the upcoming revival of Saigon and Suzatska in Toronto. Until the next time, this is Dan Dwyer. The program's been Off Script. As a dear friend of mine used to say, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.